space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise.
Clay, I know there was the book that came out in 2004 written by Christopher Booker. It's called like The Seven Basic Plots, Why We Tell Stories, where he basically breaks down all of creative fiction to be seven plots. Like every story is based off these seven plots.
What a buzzkill.
Obviously, he had never considered the fact that if you create a alien probe of unknown origin, you can apparently create 30,000 stories off of it. And Star Trek's only done a couple of them so far, but we'll get more into them, I think, as we move along. So,
well, I preferred this movie, or I should say, I was hoping this movie was going to end with the fate of the whales hinging on Jillian getting killed by a truck.
I know, yeah, it's
because this movie's basically City on the Edge of Forever with less love and more whales.
Yeah, more marine biology, I think, is the difference there. But, yeah, we're talking about Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, where Jillian does not die, the whales are saved, and everyone's happy. It's the one with the whales. And this one aired, or it came out, back in 1986. Let me just look at this real quickly. Directed by Leonard Nimoy again. Screenplay goes to Meyerson, Creekes, Meyer, and Harve Bennett. And it came out on November 26, 1986. Clay, do you know what the budget was for this movie?
Bus fare from L.A. to San Francisco.
Which, back in 1986 dollars, is $21 million, which...
What's an up-and-coming place? I can understand that.
Right. $15 million was Search for Spock. I think Wrath of Khan was like...
This was more expensive than Search for Spock?
Yeah. Does that surprise
you? Holy crap. It really does. Because 90% of the movie takes place outside.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, it does. I think we'll get into it, though.
Was most of that like kelp or something?
I think I have some explanations for it, and I think we'll get into it. I'm going to take a break, and then we are going to play an audio clip, and we're going to come back, and we're going to break down Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
From the Institute, if we play our cards right, we may be able to find out when those whales are leaving.
How will playing cards help?
Well, if it isn't Robin Hood and Friar Tuck. Where you fellas heading?
Back to San Francisco.
Came all the way down here just to jump in and swim with the kiddies, huh?
Very little point in my trying to explain.
Well, yeah, I'll buy that. What about him?
Him? He's harmless. Back in the 60s, he was part of the free speech movement at Berkeley. I think he did a little too much LDS.
LDS? Mm. Come on, why don't you let me give you a lift? I have a notorious weakness for hard luck cases. That's why I work with whales.
We don't want to be in any trouble.
You've already been that. Come on.
Okay, so this is the conclusion to the trilogy, right? This is the Wrath of Khan. We started a story that went into Search for Spock, and we end up with The Voyage Home. And I'm just going to lead off with this one just by saying I think this is the most enjoyable of the movies to watch. It might not be as good of a movie as Wrath of Khan, but I think I prefer it to Wrath of Khan in a lot of ways.
Okay, I understand that. I was talking to Dan about this because he was bummed that he couldn't be on to talk about this with us.
He likes this movie.
Yeah, I asked him if there was any thoughts that he had about it, and he said, I can't think of any off the top of my head without rewatching it, but it's right. The only Star Trek movie that both myself and my mom like to watch together. And that kind of sums it up. That sums it up pretty well, I think.
Yeah, I think it's, I don't know, like it's such a, to me it feels the truest to the series in a lot of ways, about like what they do and the adventure that they go on and the sort of, it feels like a cinematically, theatrically improved version of the show in a lot of ways, and especially coming off Search for Spock, where one of my complaints was that Spock isn't in the movie until the last 5 minutes. And how not having the trifecta really operating as well as it could kind of puts a lot of damage into a Star Trek story. Mm-hmm. They bring it all back here, and I think they do a really good job of fitting the characters for people like for Meyer and wrote this one with Harve Bennett again. They didn't like the original script, even though those two script writers are credited. They basically rewrote the whole thing.
Right.
They seem to really understand the character interactions between these people in a way that is like satisfying and fun. And even though they kind of reboot Spock in this movie, I think it works out well and everything like that. And
yeah, I was actually going to ask, is he more like the show here? Like, because it feels like they've rebooted him. He seems like he's more like Data in this movie. And I wasn't I couldn't remember if it was further, like even rebooted even more so than he was in the show. So he's even less relatable than he was in the show, or if it was just back to sort of the show era Spock.
No, I think they're hinting at his resurrection has like he had to be re-educated after his resurrection, so he's become more Vulcan because he spent all his time on Vulcan, I think is the what they're trying to say.
Oh yeah, no, I get that, but like the way that he's played, is it more?
Oh, I see what you mean.
Like the show than he was being played in the movies up to this point.
No, I don't think so. I the way he's playing Spock is more, it's definitely more robotic and okay. More like Data.
Yeah, okay.
In a lot of ways. And I don't know if that's supposed to be him sort of fine-tuning his portrayal of him, or if it's supposed to be that this is the older version of Spock as opposed to the older version of Kirk, you know, mm-hmm. where they're all kind of calming down and he's becoming more Vulcanish. Do you like the way that he's playing at this point, or do you think it's like the wrong way to go with him?
I think for this story it works really well because he is sort of ends up being the voice of the culture shock.
Yeah, yeah.
which works really well. I mean, that's something that Data does a lot in TNG, but I think Spock works really well in this movie, especially because like he's doing stuff that amps up the zaniness factor, but it's never played for zany laughs. Yep. He's just doing it because it's the thing to do.
Right.
I think he's good. I was going to say I'll be happy to see him more like regular Spock in the next one, but I don't know if I'm going to be happy to see anybody in the next one. But I think it's good for especially for his character to have a different range to play with, because he can get pretty robotic if they don't do something interesting with him.
Yeah, it's surprising to me how Data-like he is in a lot of ways. Like, it goes beyond logic. He seems to know everything at this point. Like, when he's, they have that scene where he's sort of, like, playing against the computer for some reason, like, testing mm-hmm. himself, and he seems to know, like, the question to everything that the computer can throw at him except for, dun dun dun, what do you feel? Which kind
just
of
just like in The Prisoner,
which feels like a weird question to come out of nowhere from the computer to ask him about how he feels. But he's becoming sort of like a repository. He can quote Hamlet scene and line number mm-hmm. and stuff like that, which is a little bit odd.
Not in the original Klingon, though.
No, it was translated into the King George's translation and then to English after that. Do you think that the you sound like you're more hesitant about this movie than I am. I really enjoy this one, and it's the movie that I most enjoyed watching so far. Where the others tended to... One in three, the motion picture in Search for Spock, tended to be a little dull, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. The Wrath of Khan is almost like clinically efficient in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. where I can appreciate how the plot moves in that one more than anything, but I don't feel that the characters were really whole in that one. Like, I, thinking back on it, I really don't like the Spock dying scene all that much, the way that mm-hmm. it's played.
Mm-hmm.
And I think here the characters just react to each other much more appropriately. And like, there's a couple of McCoy Spock scenes in this one that feel right to them. My favorite being, there's a scene at the beginning where McCoy wants to he's trying to thank Spock for taking his Katra back, and he's trying to be nice to him. Mm-hmm. And Spock doesn't get his reference that he's talking about, so McCoy just says, ah, fuck it, and he starts being cruel to him again. so it's that kind of stuff that I really liked. What was your takeaway? You seem a little bit hesitant towards it.
I wouldn't say I'm hesitant. This movie to me is kind of like, Are you a Rush fan? By any chance?
Yeah. I mean, I play drums, so I have to be a Rush fan, I guess.
Okay. Well, so you've got when you have a Rush album like 2112, right?
Sure. Yep.
It's a pretty sprawling, epic masterpiece of construction and story and themes and technique and all that kind of stuff. And then you also have stuff like Moving Pictures, where you have your Tom Sawyers and your Limelights, and you're so it's a good song. They play it on the radio, but it's yep. It's kind of a less heady, poppier version of what Rush does. This movie feels like one of those songs, whereas Wrath of Khan to me feels like 2112, if that gotcha. Makes sense. Where yep. it's like it's totally does. Fine. I really enjoy it. I would. You know, I wouldn't change the channel if it came on the radio or the TV, but it's, you know, it's fine. It's really fascinating to me because I feel like I'm curious what the response to this movie was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like if this movie came out in 2017, you would have a major asshole backlash to this movie, mainly because it's not even trying to be subtle about the fact that it's just like a PSA for whales,
yeah.
which I'm totally fine with. Yep. You know, it's at the time that was a big deal. I was actually wondering about that. Did we save the whales? Are they still in trouble? I have no idea. That whole thing just sort of, you know, went away.
In the movie you're talking about?
No, in the real world. That was, you know, saving the whales was such a big thing for a long time. But, you know, I guess we have other problems now, I guess.
I just think of the George Carlin bit is just like, he's like, you know, save the whales, save these snails, save the planet. And the bit is just like, you know, basically like save the planet. Like we can't even save ourselves. Now we're going to start saving the fucking planet. which is that kind of a thing. But I think that I think we have saved the whales in some way. Good. It's probably
let's
due
give
to
ourselves
movie.
A round of applause. I think we deserve it. We did a lot of work.
The movie is actually the most profitable out of all the Star Trek movies.
I heard that. Like, it did really, really well.
Yep. It made less money than the motion picture, but it cost half as much. So it actually took in more money.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so strange.
It was very... It ended Crocodile Dundee's 8-week reign at the top of the box office.
Well, someone had to knock that guy down a peg.
It made $40 million in its first 5 days. It beat the Search for Spock's opening by $14 million in that time.
I totally understand that because I think we talked about this in the Search for Spock episode. Search for Spock feels like it was made for fans of the show.
Right.
Like there's a lot of Star Trek-y stuff in there that might not be super relatable if you're, you know, especially, I mean, the entire concept is... If you didn't watch Wrath of Khan, you know, there's nothing really going to grab you about Search for Spock.
Yeah.
And if you're not super familiar with the show, you know, you might not know why Spock's a big deal. You know, it's a little bit more inside baseball, whereas this one
stands on its own pretty much.
Oh, totally. Yeah. You could take your, you know, not to sound sexist, but at the time I think this applied. You could take your girlfriend or a date to this movie. And
right.
whoever, if you being a Star Trek fan and them not being a Star Trek fan, and they would enjoy this movie.
Yeah, I was actually a little upset I didn't watch this with Amy because I think this would be a movie that she would actually like.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I think the jokes work without you having to be super super familiar with the characters because they've been playing them for so long that they get their stuff across pretty quickly.
Yeah,
and the relationships you get across pretty quickly. And it helps that the Klingon prosecutor there put that little council room screening of the
yep.
Search for Spock Blu-ray that I guess they just got, so you can get caught up on what happened in the last one. Yeah, I love it when they cut to the exterior shot of the Enterprise. where was that camera?
It's a recurring theme in the series, I guess. We have cameras everywhere.
I hate it when they do that stuff for plot reasons, where it's like clearly, yeah. Oh, we're just showing you the stuff we shot 20 minutes ago. But if you're yeah. doing that as a shorthand to recap an entire movie, I don't care. It's fine.
Right. I think they actually do, like, it's nice when they tie the recapping into the plot of the next yes. movie, which they do yeah. here. He's basically giving, like, a dissertation on why Kirk needs to be punished for what he's done.
And, I, you know, I like that stuff, too. If you want to go inside baseball with it, I like that after three, the tension between Kirk and the Klingons is kind of like a running thing that really kind of comes out yeah. in six, yep. which is nice. And so, it, you know, it's got good stuff in it. Yeah, it's a well-made movie. It's good.
Yeah. And tying into your point about the amount of people that went to go see it. They made a conscious effort in the trailers that were released to limit the amount of sort of stuff shot in the 24th century, 23rd mm-hmm. century. Mm-hmm. So the trailers basically consist of them on modern day Earth to try to
makes sense.
A trick foreign markets, which were remarkably hesitant to enjoy Star Trek. They weren't very popular in foreign markets, so they did that to try to lure that dollar and to get the American non-fan dollar at the same time.
I heard that I think I was listening to Mission Log when I was going to sleep last night. I think that's what it was. And they mentioned that the foreign market ad or poster for this movie said The Voyage Home, and then in big letters, and then in small tiny letters underneath it said Star Trek IV.
Yeah.
So they specifically were downplaying the Star Trek ad, which is really weird though, because I mean, like, it doesn't make like who. It's a much weirder movie if you don't realize it's a Star Trek movie. Like,
yes, yes.
The entire everything that happens hinges on the fact that they're from the future and they go to the past.
Yes. Yeah, I guess we'll just start with that, right? The mm-hmm. the if you explain this movie, it sounds ridiculous.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they go back in time to save humpback take a couple humpback whales into the future so that it can communicate with an alien. I think it's actually a credit to the movie that even though it's obviously a PSA, and probably the worst scene is when they're taking a tour at the very start and everyone's
that was pretty blatant.
That's pretty blatant. The movie actually does a good job of hiding the PSA through the narrative pretty well. Like nothing about the plot feels arbitrary in the sense that they did it just because they wanted to get this PSA about saving the whales in there. Like everything feels like a Star Trek plot. Right down to the reason that it's the whales is that, you know, it's Spock's line. It's like, oh, it's human arrogance to think that aliens came to Earth to talk to you.
Yeah, right? That's a good line. I like that.
That is a good line, and it does a lot to explain it. But, like, on its face, the whale story is just ridiculous. And I think that's, like, I hadn't seen this movie in a long time, so I came into it with sort of the impression of that, of it's the whale Star Trek, and I was like, it can't be that good. I can't remember it being that good. And I was pleasantly surprised by it, but I mean, it's unique in the fact, right, there's no real villain in the movie.
Right. Well, they do have my favorite character from 80s movies, which is the normal guy who just has, like, his sleeves rolled up and a button-down shirt that's on, you know, his tie's a little bit crooked.
Yes.
And he's kind of a dick, but he's not, like, a super dick.
Right.
That guy was in every movie in the 80s for some reason. He's like, what's his name? Ellis from Die Hard, but like with way less cocaine.
Oh sure, yeah.
But he's always anytime there's like a female main character, he's the one who's like, the implication is that they may have gone on a date or may
right.
have like
may
hooked
have had
up at some
yep.
point. Like what's his name? Stathis Boren in The Fly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who's that actor? Why can't I?
In The Fly?
Yeah, in The Fly.
I can't remember. I don't know. He looks just like the guy that plays Ellis in Die Hard. Okay. There must be like somewhere a folder full of, you know, early middle age, you know, normal looking dudes in undone ties.
So, you know, in the Search for Spock, I mentioned that that movie to me felt like Nimoy was trying to get the technical aspects of making a movie down.
Yeah.
I feel he's improved tenfold.
Oh, absolutely.
As
yeah.
a director.
I mean, it feels a lot more comfortable in this one.
Yes, it feels like he's like, all right, I understand all the aspects of making the movie. Now I can focus on the actual story and yep. stuff that's going on. Mm-hmm. And I guess he hired his favorite. This is actually true. He hired like a friend of his who he really liked as the director of photography, because I think this movie looks really great.
It does. I was surprised at that too. excuse me. The once they get to 1984, it looks fine.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not really a lot of interesting opportunities for
they're shooting outside. Yeah. You know. They do a lot of the sort of panning shots, not panning, but they do a lot of like the moving cart shot while carriages yes. are walking down streets. Yeah. They do a lot of that stuff.
But like, you know, the whale stuff is really nice.
Getting off the Enterprise is actually nice to shoot on the Klingon ship is lit differently, right? Like it's much more moody and yes. cinematic.
It's also considerably bigger than I think the cockpit or the bridge is considerably bigger than it was in Search for Spock, I think.
I think the ship is all bridge at this point because there's not much else going on. When you walk out that back door and you go down the ramp, other than that, you're basically sitting in the bridge the entire time. Yeah, I think that Nimoy got better at doing the sort of back and forth shots between character interactions too, which is like very prominent. I always think of it. It reminds me of the Harry Met Sally scene where Kirk goes on the date with the woman. That stuff's just shot really well. It feels like he's relishing the chance to shoot a movie that's not completely a Star Trek thing, that you have to get those Star Trek shots in.
Do you know, did he direct anything else after this?
I can
like
check.
Like in his career?
I guess I could have
looked this up. because it seems like he's more comfortable with like the more naturalistic stuff.
Yep.
And I could see him doing some good stuff. Like it's weird jumping into your directing career by shooting a Star Trek movie that takes place entirely on a different planet in space is kind of an odd choice.
Yeah, he did Three Men and a Baby, obviously.
No, well, there you go. But even there, like I can see that being much more in his wheelhouse because it's a little bit more normal and a little bit more natural, and you know,
yeah.
Oh, it seems like he's more interested in that.
Sorry, I'm just looking at his thing. I didn't realize he's the voice of Galvatron in Transformers. Oh,
yeah. Hell yeah. Yeah!
So yeah, I mean he did a couple things. I think the big one is Three Men and a Baby. Looks like that's his big sort of thing as a director, anyway. But yeah, I think he's definitely gotten more comfortable in it. I think the film feels more comfortable and it sits much better.
Yeah.
This movie is the best use of all of the cast members, not just the main three, right?
Like
there's no way that you can get around. Like they actually find a plot that has the characters have a use for things.
I think it's the first time Chekhov actually has something to do.
Yes. Yeah.
even so, I think Uhura is kind of underused. Like she had her one scene in Spock in Star Trek III, and then this one she's there, but she doesn't really do a lot. But you know,
she gets away with the the nuclear stuff. Yeah,
Chekhov does has much more to do, and I mean it makes sense that he hasn't done anything up to this point. But I mean, I mentioned it last episode, but. The stuff I haven't watched this movie probably in like maybe 15 years, if not more.
Sure. Yep.
And
have you seen other ones more recently, or is that unusual?
I've seen Wrath of Khan. I watch fairly frequently, not like all the time, but that's usually the one that I go to.
Gotcha.
I don't think I've ever watched the entirety of Star Trek V. Star Trek VI, not really. One.
Yeah.
Like I've said, I fall asleep about 10-15 minutes in. And three, I actually watched three not too long ago, but before that, I don't think I had watched it since the first time I saw it. So I don't revisit them a ton.
Yeah.
But I remember, like, for instance, I remembered less about Search for Spock than I did this one. And this one, my memories were very specific. Like, I had very specific shots and very specific scenes that I remembered from this movie. The primary of which being the computer gag with Scotty, which I think is the best thing in the movie. I'm a sucker for puns and sight gags, and that's just a plus for me.
It's the first time that they've paired McCoy and Scotty together, right? And they play off each other really well because they have a different Scotty's more of like a old-timey comic-y clown type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And DeForest Kelly plays McCoy much more of like the sort of snarky, cynical edge to it. So they pair with each other pretty well. I mean, do you think that I find the Search for Spock to be largely unmemorable, I think, is more the point than anything else about that. I found that this one has some scenes that really work well, like the Scotty sort of talking to the computer, mm-hmm. the date scene,
By the way, Kirk does have the appropriate response to drinking a Michelob.
Yes. And I like the fact that they basically call each other like shitheads. You know, they're just cursing.
Yes, double dumbass on you.
the scene with it's just got a little great little moments where they pawn he pawns his glasses and the guy says, "I'll give you $100." He says, "Is that a lot?"
Yeah, yeah.
It's a nice, relaxing, enjoyable movie, I think. And
so I was thinking, for some reason, this movie reminds me of the Richard Donner Superman. And I can't put my finger on why.
I haven't seen that recently enough to... Do you mean just the tone or like the whole sort of thing?
The tone of it and, the whole vibe of it is for some reason, I don't know why, but it's... That Superman movie is light, and
yep.
it's got a lot of Clark Kent, he's lived on Earth his entire life, but there's a lot of that same sort of humor where, you know, we know stuff about him that the people he's interacting with don't.
Oh right,
so,
yeah, sure.
So his actions are a little wink toward the camera stuff because, you know, we know he's Superman, so that he didn't actually faint, he caught the bullet, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And I guess maybe that sort of that tone, and it's very positive, and it's overall has a very positive ending, and also, well, it actually did bring me to a question I wanted to ask you. You remember how Superman ends, right? Where he spins the world backwards.
Yeah, spins the world backwards. Yeah.
Yeah. Is slingshotting around the sun a more or less believable mechanism for time travel than reversing the spin of the Earth?
I feel it's more believable, and it's also anchored by the fact that they've done it in the TV show before.
Did they do it that way in the TV show?
Yes, they slingshot it around the sun. Yep.
Oh, I thought they just pulled that out of their ass.
No, that's a recurring thing. That's like an acceptable way to go back in time in Star Trek, apparently.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still pretty thin, but
I think it makes more sense just because what's funny to me is that when they do it, right, they don't go particularly fast. They're like warp 8 and the ship starts shaking. It's like you guys have mm-hmm. gone warp 14 before. So
they're flying into the sun.
They're flying into the sun and I guess they just shoot around it, but I thought it's I guess it's effective, and it's also kind of it's funny how compared to the later series, TOS is a little bit nonchalant about going back in time mm-hmm. a lot of the time. Like they don't really have a big problem with it. And I thought that it's funny in this that they sort of get around the not interfering by the scene where Scotty talks to the computer. He has the thing where he's just like, well, how can you prove that this guy didn't invent this thing?
Yeah. There's a lot of paradoxes in this movie.
There's a lot of paradoxes.
What they should have done, though, is they should have used their tachyon pulse to create a static warp shell.
Yes, that's the only way to get around it. I mean, they parked the cloaked ship just in the middle of the park, apparently. Yeah.
I'm surprised there weren't more gags involving people running into that.
And Scotty, when Scotty's loading the plexiglass just up in the sky.
Yeah.
Oh man, it's just very. Very, very funny, but I think we should probably crack down on this. Let's talk about the plot before we go mm-hmm. into the characters. This movie's not particularly theme heavy, right? Does this a theme?
Kind of. It's the one big one. Yeah.
Okay. So to me, there's a minor plot about Spock, but in a lot of ways, it's very minor, but in a lot of ways, it's very satisfying to me.
Mm hmm.
And they have the larger theme about the whales, but outside of that, there's not really a lot that they're going at here.
Yeah.
It's not really about anything.
Not really. I mean, I think the Spock thing is satisfying in a way that they failed to do it in the first movie, because they, you know, we talked about how it seemed like, oh, they had these arcs that they had for these characters in the first movie, but they just sort of rushed through them and kind of swept them to the side in favor of long sweeping shots of floating through space. Then they would just kind of drop them, and they'd wrap them up very quickly and then not talk about them again. This one kind of does that correctly, where it's a small thematic plot arc, but they just kind of drop it in little bits across the story. So you've only got maybe like three or four beats for him to get from point A to point B, but they're satisfying because they happen along the way as he's involved in the other action of the story, instead of it just being like the way they do it in 4, where it's, we're going to talk about the theme for 5 minutes and then not talk about it again, and then he's going to go into the butthole, and then it's just like, it's over.
That's then he's gonna realize that his story has ended 45 minutes too early and to sort of wrap it up there.
Yeah, I think that his story here is, the Spock story is about him sort of coming to terms with his humanity in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And they, we answered our own question from last week. Sarek is obviously back. Amanda is back. And they were both the original actors who played Amanda's mother.
Oh, right.
They were the characters who played his parents in Journey to Babel. So they've actually got the original character, the actors back to play these roles.
And he Majel Barrett's in this one too.
Yes. Yeah, she's in it too. Apparently she was upset a lot of her stuff got cut out. She had a lot more scenes, but what are you going to do?
Yeah.
The scene with Spock and his mother is a nice way to kick off what the Spock storyline is about. And it actually fixes a lot of my problems with the character of Amanda in Journey to Babel, where I wasn't really sure what her stance on things was. And that one, she was much more of she was Sarek's wife, basically, and would sort of go along with it. She only has the one scene here, but it's important because she's the only one that, of the whole planet of Vulcan, questions Spock about what he's feeling about things. And to me, the best Star Trek scene...
It's like Vulcan's like an entire planet of Irish fathers. They never talk about emotion, and they don't want to know how you're feeling.
They don't hug.
No, they just keep it balled up inside until they die at the early age of 200.
The best Star Trek scene for me in this, I watched it a couple times because I think the scene is like excellent on almost every level, is the final Sarek and Spock scene between the two of them in the Federation Council.
Which Kirk just watches.
He's just standing.
No, you guys go ahead. Have your family moment. I'm just gonna watch.
That scene to me is really good because it's really well acted. It's well directed and it's well written. It's like the trifecta of everything you need. Basically,
it's what
you're generally aiming for in a movie. But it's those two are the two best Vulcans. And it's the reason that I like the Vulcans so much is because they're inherently conflicted about everything, right? And so it's like they're clearly happy to see each other. They play the scene as if they're clearly happy that each other are alive and that they're there and that they're happy for each other's support, but they don't show it. They have a very cordial relationship to each other. And they actually, in the scene, both do the sort of raised eyebrow at one point when the other one says something that they kind of disagree with. Sarek says that he might have been wrong about saying that Spock shouldn't have gone to Starfleet. And then Spock says something that Sarek raises, talks about his friends or something. I don't know. I think that's a really effective Star Trek scene. It might be my favorite scene in the movie, just on sort of like what it means for all the characters and everything. Did you like that scene, or did you think anything was off with it?
No, I liked it. It was good. I think Sarek is a really interesting character that they don't really give enough stuff to. Well, I guess it's tough because at this point. They're into the movies, and you can't spend an entire movie about Sarek.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I guess you probably could have in the last movie. If he had been there through the entire thing, that would have been interesting. But Sarek's really interesting because, you know, you've got Spock, who has this conflicting Vulcan versus human sides of him. So he's constantly wrestling with what side to err on the side of, of them. Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
But the thing to remember is that Sarek is the one who married a human.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I don't know entirely how Vulcan mating rituals work, but I feel like they're fairly clinical. And I think I can't remember if they do this in the maybe it's in TNG or maybe they do it in the Abrams movies. But at one point, he mentions that he married his mother because he was in love with his mother.
Yeah,
which is very not what Vulcans are into, or that's not what their thing.
Yeah.
So it's actually more interesting to me as a character to have someone who is completely Vulcan but still is wrestling with those ideas.
Yeah, he's
I guess he never got that red necklace either.
He's interesting because he's as opposed to Spock, who's like naturally sort of inclined to this kind of conflict, mm-hmm. the other characters draw it out of Sarek. In a yes. way, like he more reacts to the situation than Spock does, where Spock's more like inherently supposed to feel that way. And that's what it's an appealing character choice because he's sort of the distant father character who it's not because he's a bad guy. You know, it's because of his sort of philosophy on life
right,
and everything
right.
like that. And it's ultimately what Spock is trying to attain at the same time. And I think that they're just such a, they're both good actors and they both play it very well. And I think that, the Sarek character has always been one that it's nice that they don't reveal too much about him, but he sort of comes in for these nice, points every now and again to sort of touch base and see how things are going.
Yeah. I think doing too much with him would be a disservice to the character, but it is, it is interesting to think about his, you know, what his position actually is. I mean, and it adds to the Spock character because it does arguably add to his conflict, inner conflict, where it's like, well, I have my human side, my father's side, but my father's yep. side also has human tendencies. You know, so that does add to the internal conflict that Spock is going through. I mean, it's a really great addition to the character.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's very excellent. It's one of the good character interactions that the movie has, even though the movie has a bunch of excellent interactions. And I guess we can focus on just how much of a TOS sort of feel it feels like to me, where it's just the same character interactions, but they're all a little bit older now. Mm-hmm. And it just, I mean, we've been saying this for the past couple of movies, but it really sort of hits in this one. This is the first movie that McCoy has had anything to do. Right? Out of all of them?
Yeah, more or less. I mean,
he's in Search for Spock, but he doesn't really do anything in that movie.
Yeah, well, I think we were talking about how there could have been a lot for him to do, but they don't do it. I think that kind of hits on an inherent problem between Search for Spock and this one, and movies like this in general, or stories like this in general. When you have a team story like this, right, where you've got a crew of people on a mission or who are generally placed together, it's really not interesting to keep them together. You know,
right.
that's
yep.
with Search for Spock, we were talking about how there's really – they kind of don't have any conflict for the middle of the movie because they're all together and they want to all get to this one place, and then they all eventually get to that one place with fairly little impediment.
Right.
But here, you get to really – what brings out all of those characters is the fact that you split them up. And so you get these different interactions. I mean, someone pointed it out about Star Wars. If you watch Star Wars, you think when watching Star Wars, you think to yourself, oh, well, obviously you've got Chewie, Han, Luke, and Leia, and they're just like this group that's always together. If you actually count how much screen time they all spend together, it's not very much.
Right, yep.
Like, they don't spend much screen time together at all in the first movie. In the second movie, it's like 5 minutes, if that, before they split up. And that's where, you know, that's what allows you to play with your interactions and where your tension comes from and stuff like that, because, you know, you have a group that's together, and then you have to split them up, and then theoretically the point is to get them all back, having all completed whatever thing that they're on. So in this case, you've got, oh yeah, we've done this, oh, but Chekhov has got his brain's bleeding or whatever.
Right.
it's much more interesting than if it was just like the entire crew goes to the whale place and they see the whales, and then the entire crew goes out for Italian food with Jillian, and then the entire crew goes to the Enterprise to get the nuclear stuff.
It's a funny thing about writing, which I guess is kind of interesting. The reason you'd want to do it right is because there's only really two, maybe three outcomes of any kind of scene that you can have, right? So if you have your scene where there's two outcomes, there's really only two characters that can have a point of view in that scene. The rest of them are just kind of piling on to that.
Right.
So it makes it much more interesting if you split them up into smaller groups like this movie does, where Uhura and Chekhov go to get the nuclear power, Scotty and McCoy go to get the materials to fix the ship, and Kirk and Spock go to find the whales. They each get to play off of each other in a much better way that actually reveals stuff about the characters. And the movie's definitely the most effective out of any of them at doing that. I don't think there's a weak link story-wise. Maybe the Chekhov thing just kind of it's kind of boring, and plot-wise, I have a hard time believing that he just runs out of that interrogation room.
Oh, they would shoot him on sight. if they caught a Russian guy with questionable technology who was threatening to shoot them, and then he would get a bullet in the back of the head. Also, they fucked up too, because if they had thought a little bit, if they had remembered their history, they would have sent Chekhov off first, because ain't nothing threatening about a hot black lady just hanging around.
Right.
You know, I feel like she could have sweet talked her way out of there easier than the Russian guy did.
Yeah, that's a good point. But Chekhov being the good patriarch of society, I guess he's going to send Uhura back because she needs to do her job. I mean, the one thing that kind of annoys me in, about Chekhov in this one
is anything I just said came off as offensive. I apologize.
Chekhov says Wessel, space Wessels few too many times in this movie.
Nuclear Wessels.
Nuclear Wessels.
I actually really like that scene because it's really I think one of the things that makes all this stuff work is because there's a little bit of suspension of disbelief that they don't know how to deal with the stuff around them. When I was watching it, I started up again after my girlfriend came home, and she said it was right when they show up in 1984, and the first scene that was the double dumbass on you scene, and she said they don't understand what cars are. And I was like, that's a good point. Like they should have a better. I know it's obviously a culture shock and a time shock, but they should have a relative understanding of how some stuff works.
Well, I mean,
but the reason that it does work is because they play it all so innocently.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's nothing impure about anything that they do when they're in 1984. It's all completely innocent mistakes.
Yeah. They don't even commit a crime to get the money. Which I thought was interesting.
They don't.
They just pawn something that they
have. I believe they do in City on the Edge of Forever, right? They steal a dude's clothes.
Oh, that's right. They steal his clothes. And they blame it on the Asians.
Yes, that's right.
And in San Francisco, there was a surprising lack of Asian racism.
I will say, I don't know if I'd call it a weak plot line, but let's call it a fairly unresolved plot line. How does Sulu get a helicopter?
Yeah, why?
There's the scene where he's talking to that dude, but how does he get a helicopter?
Listen, now that Takei is out, I see every scene as dripping with homoerotic sexuality that Sulu was in, and I honestly think the scene ends right. He's like, "Can I ask you a question?" Isn't that what he says to the guy?
Something like that. Yeah.
Him flying the helicopter.
You don't see anything from Sulu for like the next hour. The next time you see him is when he's dropping off the plexiglass stuff and he just has a helicopter.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how he managed to get that.
Also, in Starfleet, why were they training him on a Huey? Because he says the thing like, "Oh, this is very similar to what I was training on when I was in the academy." What technology are they using in the 23rd century? That would be like going to racing school and training on like a horse and buggy,
and still being unfamiliar with a car at that point.
Yes, yeah.
Like, which is also funny because there are multiple episodes of the show where they go back in time and they drive cars, so you think that they'd be able to identify it. But
even that Sulu scene, I was just saying, even that scene, I do like that scene. I think it's a good scene.
The helicopter scene where he talks to the guy. Yeah, yeah.
The scene culminates in the scene where they're loading the plexiglass into the bird of prey, right? And it's just like they're, you know, it's funny because the woman runs up and she's like, "Admiral, Admiral, let me on." And Scotty looks down and he's like, "We got a problem here. They're making the biggest fucking ruckus you could possibly."
Oh, yeah.
They're helicoptering plexiglass into a guy who's floating in the sky and they're loading it into it. And they're shocked that someone has noticed that what's going on around them. Which is a nice casual touch of the script, I think.
Yeah, it's there. I don't know if I'd say this is an entirely realistic movie. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
But it not that it's meant to be in any way, but it is. I mean, you know, at that point, I think if you're not on board with that stuff by then, you know, this isn't the movie for you.
No, I think it works because the vast majority, at least all the time that they spend in 1986, is comedy. Like, everything's played very, very sort of funny. You know, even the sort of the heist scene where they get probably the greatest strength of McCoy in this is that he gets to actually be a doctor in the 20th century, which is really fantastic.
Yeah, that was pretty great.
Him arguing with the doctor about what he's going to do and just being appalled. Which is something that's actually probably rings true. Like, I'm not the first person to say this, but when we develop a better treatment of cancer, we're going to look back on chemotherapy as like basically leeches. It's like one step above leeches.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you could arguably say that people look at it that way now.
Yeah. I mean, you basically poison someone until they almost die and it kills the cancer before them, or it kills them at some point.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a nice story from McCoy that's never actually been done before on any of the show. So that's why it like struck me as a very interesting thing, because it fits his personality, right? He's going to be the guy who puts up a fight and he's not going to let the people do that to other people. And it also fits his sort of, you know, his training. He's a doctor. This is what he does.
Yeah, it's I'm surprised they didn't give him even more of like a horrified reaction when he got to the hospital, you know, because that's an interesting position to be in, where it's like, you know, if just in this one bag that I have, I could potentially save everybody's life who's in this building.
that's true. The magical pill he gives the dialysis woman and stuff like that. Yeah, he could arguably you'd say they should leave McCoy in the past to cure all the suffering that's been going on, right?
Which well, I mean, if you want Paradox City, sure.
Which is a nice way to segue the female character in the movie, right? Name's Jillian, right?
Yeah,
Jillian.
Yes, but I was going to mention, when you were naming off all the people who came back for this movie, you did forget one, because they poochie her out of this movie very quickly, which is Savick.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Do you know what the original change, do you know what the original script called for and why she was left behind?
I have no idea.
She's pregnant in the original script.
That's stupid.
Yeah. But it confirms that they actually had sex on the planet Ponfar. Her and 13-year-old Spock actually did the deed.
The way that they write her out of this movie is just so hilarious, because it's just it did really remind me of that Poochie episode of The Simpsons when they write him out of Itchy and Scratchy, where it's just like, I have to go now. Yeah, because Kirk literally like grabs her by the shoulders and says, "Well, I guess this is goodbye." That's it. She's just gone.
She has one line, which she delivers better than anything she delivered in Search for Spock, when she says goodbye to Spock.
She really had time to focus on that one.
And then she's out the door. Savick, we barely knew you. I wish you had stayed. What can I think of the actress's name? Christy Alley.
Kirstie Alley.
Yeah, I wish you had stayed Kirstie Alley the entire time. And Robin Cook, or whatever your name is not really...
Curtis, I think.
Curtis. You know what she... you remember the TNG Gambit episode? The one where Picard pretends to be a rogue who like is on that ship with all the hijackers?
Yes.
She's the Romulan in that.
Is she really?
Yeah, that's that actress. But anyway, what do you think of this Jillian Taylor character?
You know, I was joking, but I wasn't super joking. I think she's basically an updated version of the Joan Allen. Is it Joan Allen from City on the Edge of Forever? Whatever the name.
Oh,
I can't remember the actress. I think it's Joan Allen.
Okay, yeah.
Is it?
No. I don't know.
I don't, but you know who I mean.
I do. The woman.
Yeah, it's the same kind of, like, she even has the thing where she picks him up on the street and she's like, oh, I guess I just have a penchant for picking up drifters or something. You know, it's the same, she's the same kind of character who's got a righteous cause that she's fighting for, but also has a soft spot for, I don't know, Fleet Week, I guess.
Which of those characters is more over the top in their beliefs?
City on the Edge of Forever.
Okay.
Yeah,
I find the Jillian, I think her name is Taylor, I find this Jillian character too, she starts off not particularly impressive, but her turn by the end of the movie is kind of remarkable to me. You know, basically, it starts off with her being like, you know, Dr. Whale, basically, where everything's about the whales and all this stuff. And she slaps the shit out of that guy for giving the whales away and things like that. And she's, you know, she's sort of hysterical about it. The fact that, A, she doesn't end the movie in a relationship with Kirk, only to be abandoned by the start of the next movie.
Joan Collins. Edith Keeler, yeah.
She is not in a relationship with Kirk. She actually leaves him to go actually stick with her passion. Right,
which I thought was great. I love that.
That's great, and it's something that the Star Trek show never did. Remember all the episodes we made fun of you know, the woman paleontologist who falls in love with Khan because he flashes his pecs at her and she just can't resist. She gives up her entire career just to be by Khan's side.
Oh yeah,
they don't do that with her in this, and it's really kind of remarkable that Kirk basically gets, you know, stood up at the altar in a lot of ways at the end of the movie, and she's just like, you know, I'm going to go study whales in the future, and I'll see you later.
I completely believe. See, that's every now and then I feel like you get these things that happen in movies where clearly, for once, they looked at the cliche way to play something and they actually thought about it and thought about, well, what would the accurate, realistic reaction be here?
Mm-hmm.
And I 100% believe that if she was taken to the 23rd century, even if she did kind of have a crush on Kirk, her response would be, dude, I'm in the 23rd century. I'm going to go learn about everything I could possibly learn about being a scientist and being the only person on Earth that knows how whales work. Like, no, I could totally believe that. Totally believe it.
Apparently it was a controversial ending for some people. Some people wanted her to be sent back to the 20th century. Some people liked the way that it ended here in the movie. What's your opinion about that? Do you have any particular feeling one way or the other?
I think it makes more sense than this stuff usually does. Like in City on the Edge, if they had taken Edith Keeler to the future, I don't think that makes much sense, because if you extrapolate what happens after that, it's like, all right, well, now she's in the future. Good luck, I guess.
Right.
Sure. This one, they're bringing her to the future. They actually say it in the movie, or she says it, where she's like, well, I'm the only person on Earth who knows how these things work.
Yeah.
And
that's good logic, actually.
Yeah, so having her there, it excuses the act. It excuses doing it, but it also makes narrative sense to have done it.
Nicholas Meyer, I guess, was the main proponent of not bringing her back, and his reason would be that he thought the message would be more about people of the you know, our present, which is Star Trek's past, have to accept responsibility for things instead of escaping to a utopian future where everything is just fixed for you.
I can see that.
Which I think works on like a thematic level. I think that the ending, that the way that it ends here, is actually a better movie ending.
Yeah.
Than that.
I can appreciate that point of view, but I think that's going to be a really hard sell to get across.
It's like, also way more cliche, I think.
Yeah. But, like, I mean, how do you really get that across unless someone says it?
Right. Someone would have to say it. That's the problem.
Because it's not like if Jillian was, like, a negative character, maybe, where, you know, but, like, having her be such a positive character and such a positive force for the whales, and then just be like, oh, well, we'd love to bring you into the future where you can reach the apex of your life's work, but you really should deal with what's going on here first. Yeah, I don't know. That would be a tough sell.
I mean, they need her to deal with the horribly inbred whales that they're going to have in the 23rd century. So,
well, I mean, by that point, you can clone that shit. I'm surprised they haven't done that already.
I know.
I mean, I guess they were extinct, so they couldn't. But now that they have them, You can claw
John Hammond. John Hammond wouldn't walk up with a gigantic cane with Amber and a whale stuck on the end.
Yeah. That would be a much more docile version of Jurassic Park. Oh no, the humpback whales have gone docile.
Do you
not crazy?
Do you? I guess we'll wrap it up with this sort of general point of the movie. Do you buy the whales or do you not buy the whales? Are the whales a problem for you in this movie?
No. I think it's fine.
Yeah.
It's a silly concept for a silly movie.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that. I don't want that to sound like
negative on it.
Yeah. It's not. I'm not trying to be reductive or detrimental to it. It's just like it's a problem that fits the tone of the movie.
Yep. Yes.
And it's something that's difficult too. You know, it's not like because it's something that if it was some other animal, it would be like, oh well, let's just get one,
yes,
put it in a cage and bring it onto the ship. This one is actually like comically oversized that the logistics of getting it A onto the ship and B back in time are ridiculous.
That's actually a reason why it was the whale. It was originally going to be some sort of creature from the rainforest, like a frog or something. Mm-hmm. And they realized that like you actually need some kind of drama about how do you actually get the thing as opposed to just going and catching one. So yeah, they turned them into whales. And I think that thematically the whales kind of work. It's almost like nice foreshadowing, you know, when the alien probe shows up and it's making those like horrible noises. I watched this movie on a tablet, so I was listening through headphones, and it's actually very unpleasant to listen to the opening through that because of the shrieking. But it's the whale songs it naturally sort of ties into the probe sound. Like you don't have it's not a stretch to go from the noises that the probe are making to the noises that the whales are making. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of like a cute little like, oh, that is kind of neat that they could sound like that and that it actually makes sense in terms of the movie and everything.
Yeah, I do have to say, though, they really didn't do too many passes on the design of that probe.
No, that probe is terrible.
It's like the inanimate carbon rod from that episode of The Simpsons. It's just like a big Caitlin referred to it as it looked like a piece of broken pencil.
To me, when it's flying in, it kind of looks like a water bottle with the little thing that you push the button on the top to get the water to come out the spout.
Yeah.
And then it's yes. And then it stands up and it looks like it has a little glowing penis, and that's kind of adorable, yeah, too. So that's but it's just a I'm looking at my office now, I have like a little black foam roller, and I think that's mm-hmm. the inspiration for the probe. It's just a black cylinder.
That's definitely like three designs in, 2 days, like the night before they needed a new design. he was just looking around the room, just being like, well, no, that looks too much like a lamp.
Yeah.
You know, one of those things. Having been there, I know that's probably how it went.
Let's wrap this up with what I thought we can sort of talk about the structure of the movies so mm-hmm. far, right? If I was remaking this series, I would move Spock's death to after this movie.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, because I know what you mean. Yeah,
I feel that Spock's death in the context of everything comes a little bit too early, and he kind of needs to get to his humanity and then have the tragedy of his death happen.
I see, yeah, yeah.
And one of the things that's really impressive about this movie is that the TOS, the series, had a really, really, really hard time with coming up for arguments that make sense for McCoy to have against Spock. Right.
Mm-hmm.
McCoy's arguments were always a little bit absurd and like overly emotional. You know, it'd be like, you're clearly not thinking about this. Like they'd be on a planet and Kirk would get stuck and Spock would say, we have to go blow up the meteor that's going to hit this planet. And McCoy's argument would be like, we need to find Kirk and save him from the planet. We shouldn't leave. And it's like, well, clearly, if you blow up the meteor that's going to kill him, you'll save Kirk at the same time. Why don't you do that?
Right, right, right.
Here, his argument. The argument that's been stretching across a couple of movies is the idea that whether or not you can argue that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, or if you can somehow flip that. And I think they do a pretty effective job of arguing, if it's not logically correct, it at least makes an emotional level of sense to sometimes have the needs of the few outweigh the needs of the many in a lot mm-hmm. of ways. Like if everyone is concerned about their friend, their sacrifice to try to save their friend sort of diffuses the responsibility, and it feels like it's logical more than it is. And so that's the turning point for Spock in this movie, is that he realizes that his friends are going to sacrifice. It's illogical for them to do so, but they're all going to potentially sacrifice themselves to save him. His death at that point would make more thematic sense and tie into his arc through the movies.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, you could argue that the way they have it works, in that he starts out in the first movie as trying to obtain total
Kolinar.
Yeah.
Yep.
Total protonic reversal. and then through the course of his actions in the second movie, up through his return in the third, and ultimately the way he goes through things in the fourth movie, he's kind of swinging back the other way. You know, like he starts out as wanting total logic, and then ends up coming to terms with his emotional side. I don't think
humanity.
I don't think it's that clean of a through line to really be like, oh, well, yeah, clearly that's the story arc. I think what you're saying would be a little cleaner.
Yep.
And, you know, I think it would... Man, that would be such a fucking bummer. I mean, it's as much... I mean, it's a bummer as it is in Wrath of Khan, but it's like, you come off of Star Trek IV, everybody's happy. Spock's, you know, he's got like he's like, yeah, I finally understand how humans work. And then he fucking dies from radiation poisoning.
He's reconciled with his father and everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like it's... I just don't feel that the death scene in Wrath of Khan works that well. To me, the Sarek and Spock scene at the end of this movie is more emotional than the death of Spock in Wrath of Khan in a lot of ways.
I see. Yeah. I guess. Yeah, I think it's kind of tough, at least for me, to really judge how purely emotionally effective the Wrath of Khan death scene is, just because it's so famous.
Yeah, and you know he's coming back, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, it's... I didn't see it when it came out, and I wasn't... By the time I did see Wrath of Khan, I was already familiar with the characters, and I probably saw the other ones before I saw that one, if I'm being honest.
Right.
I know that I saw Star Trek VI when it was in the theater. And I think probably saw the other ones after that. I don't know. It's kind of like the obviously not as big of an impact, but it's kind of like the Luke, I am your father thing. It's just sort of one of those things you know going in at this point.
Right.
That's the big moment. That's, you know, somebody spoils that for you really early.
Yeah.
When you're coming to it this late. But yeah, that's interesting. I think you're probably right that the Sarek and Spock scene is probably more honestly emotionally effective, a little more subtly emotionally effective. It's not the big swelling musical score accompaniment emotionally effective that you would have at like the climax of one of these movies.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is what they're going for more with the death of Spock, even though. I don't know if I ever really noticed that there's actually no music in that scene in Wrath of Khan, which is interesting. And probably for the better, because that would be a little bit too much.
Yeah, I think they're just relying on the raspy vocals of Leonard Nimoy, I think, for the music. That's another thing I would change, but I don't want to go down that rabbit hole too much. So we'll wrap it up with the final shot of this. Are you happy that the Enterprise 1701A... is exactly the same ship that we've seen before?
Well, first of all, I do want to say I was wrong, because I thought the 1A was the Excelsior ship. But the Excelsior ship is the B, which they don't
the
actually
B,
get.
Yeah.
Which they don't actually get until Generations, which I didn't realize.
Because
they're christening the Enterprise B when Kirk gets killed there.
I think I was confused about that too. But yeah, the Excelsior is the B, and then the C is the one that you see in yesterday's Enterprise.
Yeah, which I could have sworn the B showed up earlier, but apparently not.
I'm a little disappointed it's the same exact ship.
I think so. I mean, I like I said last episode, I really like that ship. I specifically the movie design. I really like that version of the ship. But yeah, you'd think that they would, you know, do something new to it. Maybe give it like a new racing stripe on the side.
It's a new bridge, and the bridge looks great. It looks like a Apple Store version of the bridge.
It looks 100 times better than the Excelsior Bridge does in Search of Spock.
that's true.
I don't know what they did, if they added some like lights on the floor or something, but it's a similar bridge, but it's way better looking.
Yeah. I'm a little disappointed that it's the exact same thing except for the interior, which is kind of a weird choice. And I don't know. I feel like it should have been a little bit updated or something like that. But we're going to be stuck with these ships.
They usually streamline it a hair every time.
Right.
You know, I expected the neck to be a little shorter or something like that.
Yeah. Nacelles stick out a little bit more. But yeah, we're going to have the Enterprise A for the rest of the movies. It sticks around until 6. So this is the ship we got. And this is the ship that it is. So do you remember, we'll give it out the way that we started. Do you remember why Dan said that he liked this one besides his mother? Or was that just the big thing that stuck in his mind? It was the movie that he could watch with his mother and feel okay about it.
That was the only the interaction I had with him about it was that. And then he was thinking about it more and he was like, wow, there's a lot of time paradoxes in this movie. Because Scotty gives him that thing and then like the Bones does it and check it. I was like, yeah, but they don't seem to care. So, and then he was like, isn't this entire movie like a gross violation of the Prime Directive? Did they have the Prime Directive in the original series?
I think they did. They did, yeah. They do. I don't think you can. TNG did that too. You can't see. You apparently can't Prime Directive humans. Like, even, no matter what their situation is, it's impossible to Prime Directive humanity, I guess.
I don't know if I agree with that.
I don't agree with it either.
Yeah, because you could argue that if you're going back in time, you're going to a point where humans are essentially a different race.
Right.
Because of their technological advancement and all that kind of stuff. So, I don't know. Starfleet might need to rewrite that book.
Yeah.
One other thing I wanted to mention. Worst music so far. I really hated the music in this movie.
Oh, did you hate it? I found it more just forgettable.
Yeah. I guess that's what bothered me about it is the first one has such obviously iconic music. The second one, I like the music in the second one. It's not quite as iconic as the first one. Third one basically just reuses all the stuff from the second one.
Yes.
This one, they got a new composer, and it's just really – it's very stock sounding.
Yes,
I had the same problem with Rogue One, where I guess the original composer had to back out super late into the process, and so they brought in Michael Giacchino, who actually wrote the music for Star Trek 2009, mm-hmm. which is a fantastic score. And it's just not good. It feels like when the credits come up in Rogue One and like the music comes up, it feels like someone trying to write a Star Wars-y type music score.
Sure, yeah.
It almost feels like it's Spaceballs or something, where it's like, this is what these movies usually have. And I had the same feeling here, where it's like, this doesn't feel right. This feels like you're trying really hard to write a Star Trek theme.
Yeah,
and it's just not, it's not working.
Yeah, I felt the same way. It's just, it's not as memorable as the other movies are. The other movies feel like they're more, like you're saying, they're more like tailored to Star Trek. They're like songs that fit in the universe of Star Trek.
Yeah.
This one, it just feels like it's sort of typical movie music.
And the whole opening credits, too. They felt like the credits felt really cheap.
Have they done a movie yet where the credits aren't just the names on black screen?
I guess not, but I don't know. There's something felt really weird about it because it was, you know, the kind of stock music and then the names just, you know, coming up over that still shot of like a nebula or something.
Yes.
It just, I don't know. It felt really TV to me.
Mm, yeah, that's a good way to put it, I think. Yeah.
It's not quite as good as Star Trek VI where everybody gets to sign their name at the end.
The old John Hancock. Well, I think we're going to wrap this one up. Do you want to give your rating first before we go to me?
I'm going to go 4 on this one because it's better than Search for Spock, which I gave a 3. I don't like it as well. That's not the word. I shouldn't say it that way. As we've gone through 7 seasons of TNG and the smattering of TOS and into these movies, you should know by now that the things that really grab me are interesting concepts and character concepts and consequences that are really just sort of screwed together in the right combination. And yep. This is a totally fine movie. It's really enjoyable to watch. It's fun. It's a great way to hang out with the characters for 2 hours and watch them do fun things. But it doesn't hit that sweet spot the way that Wrath of Khan does for me.
Okay.
Because Wrath of Khan, you know, there's so many things going on that I find more thematically interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
Whether or not it's a lighter movie to put on, you know, I go through that sometimes too, where there's a lot of things where, or a lot of series where, what is traditionally the best movie or episode is not the one I'll go to. It'll be an easier one to just kind of breeze through and hang out with. That's just a very satisfying episode or film or something like that. And I think that's what this movie is. You know, this is a movie that you could put on any time and enjoy.
Right. So your overall ranking so far would be Wrath of Khan, this one, Search for Spock Motion Picture?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
They're basically in order of the number, except for I think 5 is going to take the 2 spot. Although I don't know, 5 might take the 1 spot. I haven't watched it all the way through. It's something else.
I'm looking forward to it. I think we're differing on the movies more than we are on the TV show, which is interesting to me because I would rank them 4. I'd rank them Voyage Home, Wrath of Khan, Motion Picture, Search for Spock.
Oh, did you rank Motion Picture ahead of Search for Spock?
Yeah, I really don't like Search for Spock all that much.
I guess maybe I'm remembering incorrectly, but I can't remember exactly what I'd said about that compared to the Motion Picture, which is funny because we just did it 2 days ago.
So. I think you guys can ignore my movie ratings because they kind of fluctuate based on the other movies that come out, less so than the episodes of the TV show do. I feel like I can nail in what the rating is for the episode of the TV show more than I can for the movies because the movies change depending on how the others rub up alongside them in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And I just thought Search for Spock was so boring. It was like uninteresting in a way that the Motion Picture is extremely boring, but it's like fascinating in how boring it is in a lot of ways.
I guess if I'm thinking about it, the best way I can think about it is movies I would recommend. Which ones I would recommend to people. And I would be hard-pressed to not recommend Wrath of Khan very, very highly.
Sure.
Even if it's not necessarily what, you know, people are looking for, because I tend to do that sometimes. but like for casual fan, Wrath of Khan might not be the best way to jump into the series. In that case, I would say probably I'd recommend 4 over Wrath of Khan. But if I'm just going like pure recommendation, I would say Wrath of Khan first, this one second. And that's tough. 3 and 1 is tough because it's, you know, like I said about 1, it's really fascinating. You know what? I would recommend 1 over 3 because I don't think there's really anything interesting enough, even in the weird way, in Search for Spock for me to say you should watch that over the first one. The first one at least has I could talk about it in a way that would make you interested to watch it. Let's put it that way.
Right. Yeah. Yes. I think the podcast might bear that out too. It's just 3 to me feels like it's really just sort of there to string together 2 and 4. Like it's like it doesn't have a. There's no story in 3 that drives you back to it. Like it feels very much like it's just a placeholder where it's waiting for something else to happen. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see where 5 and 6 sort of settle up against these things. I'm going to give it I'm going to give Voyage Home a 5. I think it's up there with Wrath of Khan. Khan is probably, as I said, the better movie, on its face and the one that you'd probably recommend if to someone who'd not seen any of them, if they can only watch 1, but Voyage Home might be the more watchable movie to me.
I'll be honest with you. I feel the same way This is actually funny. I hadn't thought about this until just now. I feel the same way about this movie and Wrath of Khan as I do about City on the Edge of Forever and Balance of Terror.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Because, like, I feel like they're kind of they're very solid analogs of each other. Where, you know, if you're going for the ultimate Star Trek experience on film, Wrath of Khan is my pick.
Yeah.
But yeah, this one's really good too. But I think if you want a little bit of everything that make what makes Star Trek Star Trek, at least as far as I'm concerned, I would go Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, that's I think that's a good way to wrap it up. Guys, thank you very much for listening. If you enjoyed the content, you're on YouTube, like and a comment's appreciated. iTunes, all the podcatchers, if you rate us on there, it helps the show out a great deal. Facebook.com/thePenske podcast. And lastly, patreon.com/thePenske file. Patreon.com/thePenske file. If you enjoy what we do, you can go there, give a couple dollars a month to get exclusive podcast content. We talked about Miami Vice and Mad Men will be coming out soon, and we're going to be putting up a poll for what's coming out in June after I get back from my short vacation. So hopefully
my vote, I know you wanted to do all of these, but my vote is Alien Resurrection.
Yep.
Because first of all, I watched Alien 3 like last week, and I don't care to watch it again.
I like Alien 3.
okay, well, we could probably have a discussion about it then. And Alien and Aliens, it's like, what really is there to say
that's true.
Already been said? You know, it's there. But Alien Resurrection is one that I haven't seen, I think, since it came out on video, and it's very traditionally maligned as being terrible.
Yep.
So much like Star Trek V, which I am actively excited to watch in a way that I never thought I would be, I would be interested to watch that movie.
Yeah. I think that's, we'll put up the Alien Resurrection, on the poll, I think, for June, but yeah, that'll be late June because I'll be gone for a little bit. So you guys can, have your fill of Star Trek movie episodes, and then we'll catch up at the end of June and see where that goes.
Are there any cool sci-fi, things in, you're going to Scotland, right?
I am, yeah.
Are there any cool sci-fi things that you could take pictures next to in Scotland?
Nessie, I guess, right? That's kind of sci-fi.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I guess that's it. You could go to Port Marion if you want to drive for like 5 days down the entire length of England.
No, it's the funny thing about the British. My family's British, so I feel like I can say this, even though it's not racist. It feels like I'm saying something racist. The British have a funny sense of distance. You know, because we live in America and I'll drive like 30 miles to go get a good taco or something. Yeah. Sometimes like the British have a funny, my grandparents are this way where they'll consider leaving town to be like something they need to prepare for. Like it's like it must just be the sense of scale of living on an island where another country is, you know, basically a 3 hour drive. You can get to another country.
Right.
We don't have that in America.
Yeah, I mean, on mainland England, drive 30 miles for a taco, you'll literally be in Spain. You know, if you go through like four different countries just to get that taco. I know tacos, I don't think, come from Spain. Really? Right? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, chalupas come from Spain. But yeah, that's pretty much it. That's my waxing poetic on the British and their driving. But we're going to be back with Star Trek V, The Final Frontier.